Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why the Democrats lost the uphill race they hoped to win in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, and speak with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We will discuss how the successful demonization of Hillary Clinton by the Republicans in the last election was updated to target Nancy Pelosi in yesterday's election and tie her to John Ossoff, who was depicted as her puppet. We will explore why people prefer to believe that Nancy Pelosi is a monster without any apparent evidence to support the demonized portrait of her that GOP operatives so successfully employed. Using dog whistle coded appeals, they imply John Ossoff was not one of us, but a gay-loving San Francisco sanctuary city type who wants to hand out benefits to undeserving minorities while looking down on hard-working white folks who the Democrats don't care about that have been left at the back of the queue. Then we'll examine the absence of American leadership with a commander-in-chief who is AWOL in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, where the Russians appear to be running the show and making the rules. Kate Brennan, the deputy managing editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, joins us to discuss her latest article at Foreign Policy, White House Officials Push for Widening the War in Syria Over Pentagon Objections, and how hawks on the National Security Council are working behind the backs of the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor to confront Iran and its proxy forces. Then finally, we will assess the elevation of Saudi Arabia's 31-year-old Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the role of Crown Prince by his father, King Salman, passing over his older uncle, Prince Nayef. Dr. Ali Al-Yami, the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss this palace intrigue and his latest article at cdhr.info, Settling Scores with Qatar in the Guise of Defeating Terrorism, and how the Saudis are shamelessly stroking Trump's ego while playing him like a gullible fool. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He is a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, and his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Great to be back.
And dog whistle politics came back with a vengeance in this recent race down in Georgia, where the Democrats were obviously hoping they could strike a blow against Trump, and they fell short. And of course, Trump is quite triumphant, and I'm sure a lot of the people down there who work so hard down there in Atlanta, Georgia, are feeling despondent. But one thing I noticed about the race, and particularly with the ads that were played for Karen Handel and the coverage on the news, every time you had a Republican voter on, they would invariably say the same thing. It was like everybody was on the same hymnal. Oh, that John Ossoff is a puppet of Nancy Pelosi's. So it strikes me that the Republicans, who did such an extraordinary job demonizing Hillary Clinton as a criminal, lock her up, have successfully demonized Nancy Pelosi. So in terms of dog whistle politics and coded racial appeals, how does misogyny fit into that spectrum?
So I think what we're seeing is a politics that on the right is based largely on exploiting social divisions as a divide and conquer weapon. It's a way for people on the right to say, fear other people, don't worry about the corporations that are actually running the party and running the country. Those social divisions in the United States have historically been a race, as at least over the last 50 years. But gender is a very close second. If you think back to the civil rights movement, you had demands for equality on the basis of race, but also demands for equality on the basis of gender. And it's those demands that created a sort of a, a latent reaction, a sort of an anxiety about people's position in society as whites or as men, or we might add as straight or as Christian, right? These are social anxieties that, okay, they exist in society, we can deal with them, but rather than deal with them, we've had a political party that said, that's not a crisis, that's an opportunity. Let's exploit these fears and convince people that the greatest enemies in their lives are other people who just want to be treated equally, and convince them that government's really the problem when government backs up these claims for decent and fair treatment. And don't worry about the corporations. We'll run the country for the benefit of the corporations, but keep promising to protect you from these people who want to be treated as people. And I think you see that again in Georgia. The constant refrain was, he's not one of us. He doesn't live in the district. He's a foot soldier for Nancy Pelosi. He's not one of us. And underlying that is a campaign rooted in social anxiety rather than a conversation about how power is actually working and the dedication of the Republicans to gutting health care, to massive tax cuts for the rich, to stoking social divisions so that they can ultimately help the Koch brothers and major polluters.
But what's the mechanism or the underlying psychological explanation for why the Republicans were so successful in demonizing Hillary Clinton? You know, you could argue that she and her husband got a little greedy and obviously liked making money, but they're not evil people. They're not criminals, as far as I can tell. She seems quite, an earnest, hardworking, decent person. But they made her into this monster. And they're doing the same thing. They did the same thing down in Georgia with Nancy Pelosi, who, really, I don't think you can make a case against her fitting the kind of venom that was spewed at her by any margin. I mean, it's just, I'm just trying to fill up this disconnect between who these people really are and how they have been portrayed and demonized, and what mechanism allows people to make that leap from who these people are in reality to this sort of hideous portrait of them that they seem to want to believe, as opposed to, investigate whether or not these charges are true.
Yeah, I think you've really hit it on the head when you use the phrase that they want to believe. Because I think that what we're seeing here is a process of lies that are supposedly transmitting a deeper truth. And so what are the lies? Well, the lies are that Hillary Clinton has been involved in, Vince Foster's murder, or that she's running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor in the suburbs of D.C., and, that Nancy Pelosi is this terrible monster. Those are all blatant lies, and I think that, frankly, many Republicans recognize them as blatant lies. If they listen to Alec Jones, it's as entertainment. He's a liar. Most people. But at the same time, the danger comes because many people on the right understand those lies to actually be communicating a deeper truth. And the deeper truth that they hear is liberals really care about women, about gays, about black and brown people, about immigrants. They don't care about me. And society's changing. I don't recognize my position in society. All these other people are cutting in line ahead of me. I'm really the one that's deserving because it's people like me who made this country great, and we founded the country, and we work hard. But all these other undeserving people are cutting ahead of me, and Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton and Democrats, they're betraying me. And I think that's the deeper truth that many people on the right hear, and that's the art of dark was a politics. To convince average, decent folks, hey, the real problem in your life is these other people who are getting something that they shouldn't, who are cutting in line when they shouldn't. You're really special. You're deserving. these other people are monsters. They're, you know, to use Trump's language, drug dealers and rapists. And I think that so on the one hand, we see these absurd lies. I mean, who could possibly believe them? But at the same time, we're not addressing, I think that Democrats and liberals generally are not addressing what seems to many people this deeper truth. Hey, that liberals don't actually care about whites, men, Christians, straight people, right? There's a sense of they really care about minorities. They don't care about, you know, to resurrect Richard Nixon's phrase that Trump also has been using, the silent majority.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He is a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, and his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So what then can be done to break down these walls between these two alternative universes that have developed here in the United States? Obviously, the Democrats thought that they had a chance to strike a blow against Trump. And what they don't seem to understand, as much as they can't stand Trump and find him appalling, that Republicans actually like him and that his support amongst Republicans remains very high, even though his overall approval ratings are down somewhere between 30 and 40, which is pretty low. And he's only been a little more than 150 days in, and it's been something of a train wreck by any objective measure, but that's not how they see it. So should be their strategy. I mean, Ossoff was trying to, this is their paradox, obviously. In these swing districts, because of gerrymandering, there's so few chances of the Democrats taking these House seats, so they have to run moderate Democrats in these kind of mostly red, slightly purple states like this Georgia 6th District. So to appeal to disaffected Republicans who aren't as numerous as they thought, you have to tack to the right. And then in doing so, of course, you alienate your Democratic base. So it's an exquisite dilemma for the Democrats, isn't it?
I think it's only a dilemma if you understand the sort of economic populism and social liberalism as choices that are in tension. Look, I think that John Ossoff in some ways made both the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, and sort of he made two crucial mistakes. One, he ran as an economic centrist. People aren't economic centrists anymore. Whether you're on the right or the left, the vast majority of people in the United States understand that the economy is rigged. The difference between the right and the left is that people on the left say the economy is rigged to help the very rich. People on the right say the economy is rigged to favor the corporations and also the very poor, which is why they hate the left, right? So, but both groups, everybody understands the economy's rigged. Enough with economic centrism, let's say the economy's rigged. Here's the other big mistake. Ossoff ran as this diversity candidate, embracing Islam, embracing transgender rights, embracing women, but in a way that solidified the right-wing narrative that says Democrats really only care about minorities, without taking the extra step, and this is a crucial point. Yeah, absolutely, embrace equality, embrace transgender rights, embrace women, embrace people of color, embrace immigrants, and then say social divisions are used as a divide-and-conquer weapon to hurt white people, to hurt men, to hurt Christians, to hurt straight people. Show people that you're talking about identity, you're talking about equality, not just because you care about these other historically disadvantaged groups, but because you care about all people. And that, in fact, whites and men and straights and right, the whole gamut, everybody in this country has a stake in promoting equality and in for everyone and in overcoming social division as a divide and conquer weapon. Right? And so what you really need from the Democrats is a two-pronged message that comes together and says, we need an economy that works for everybody. And to get there, we need to realize that the problem in our lives are not other people. We need to reject divide and conquer politics. The big problem in our lives is the corporate capture of the Republican Party and, frankly, a significant segment of the Democratic Party as well.
So, in other words, it's futile for the Democrats to say to these disaffected white working-class voters that used to be a part of the FDR coalition that they've lost, that you're basically being taken advantage of by this demagogue whose entire life has been about his own ego and rampant selfishness, and he doesn't give a damn about you, and he's just manipulating you in order to get support so that he can use the power of the White House to enrich himself and his family. That's a futile argument. You're saying
no. I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying that is the argument. But not in
a confrontational way. Is that what you're saying? Rather than confront people. Go ahead.
I'm saying don't go after people by saying, hey, you're a bigot. That's not going to be productive. Create an opening for people by saying, this is a divide and conquer weapon. You recognize this. Trump, the Republicans, they're used car salesmen. They're ripping you off. They're telling you, fear other people. Don't worry about who's actually making all the money and pulling all the strings. But once you see that, you can see that the biggest threat in your life does not come from other people. It does not come from immigrants or Muslims or what have you. It comes from corporations running a rigged economy. We're all in this together. And so this, we're all in this together, is a positive message that grounds dog whistle politics and cold score politics by saying this is the tactic that's being used against you. That's the sort of negative part. And the positive part is by overcoming this tactic and by joining with other people, we can actually get this country back from the very rich and from the corporations, and that's the economic populism. But you need both. And what I worry about from what I'm hearing from the Democratic Party right now is they're refusing to talk seriously about how equality issues and identity issues are being used as a divide and conquer weapon. And they think that they can have a conversation with voters just about economic populism. That's not going to work, because I think most voters, most white working class voters, yes, they're struggling economically, but they see their economic struggle through the lens of race and through the lens of gender. And if you don't address those ways of seeing their economic position, you can never convince them that the way forward, the way past a rigged economy, is by joining with other people. Because in their minds, the rigged economy is rigged partly to help these people that they're uncomfortable with, that make them anxious. Immigrants, minorities, Muslims, the whole business.
Well, Ian Haney-Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He is a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, and his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the absence of American leadership with a commander-in-chief who is AWOL on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria.
Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kate Brennan, the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for Foreign Policy, and she has an article at Foreign Policy exclusive, White House Officials Push for Widening War in Syria Over Pentagon Objections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Brennan.
Thank you for having me.
And it does seem that with Raqqa about to fall and the Islamic State losing territory, that the Assad regime, the Iranians, and the Russians are trying to fill the vacuum as ISIS gets rolled up. There are also reports from analysts that the Iranians or the Syrian regime would like to have a land corridor from Assad's territory across Iraq into Iran. So there are lots of motives on the other side with terms of the Assads, the Russians, and the Iranians. They've always seemed to know what they want. We, on the other hand, don't seem to know what we want. And that's my impression from reading your article, not just that there's a battle going on within the White House itself between the hawks on the National Security Council and the adults in the room like General Mattis and General McMaster, but in general, we seem to have a commander-in-chief who's AWOL.
I think that's right. I think he's delegated a lot of responsibility, as has been reported, to the military, both in Syria and Afghanistan, across the board. So I think what you're seeing is, in that vacuum of leadership and clear policy direction, different sides within this policy debate vying for influence and hoping that their side sort of is the dominant one at the end of the day. And I think you're also right that some of this is the war against ISIS is rounding a corner. Mosul is almost, the battle there is wrapping up, or at least I'd say more than halfway over. They're gearing up to take back Raqqa. And so some of what I think we're seeing is folks on all sides, whether it's Russia, Iran, the U.S., starting to think about what happens next and trying to counter each other as different territory is seized.
But it seems that the U.S. has a real dilemma here, because the surrogates or the proxies that are fighting, and well, obviously in the case of the Iraqi Shia militias and the Iraqi army, which is Shia army, the U.S. has a relationship with them. But on the other side, in Syria, the only people we have to work with, apart from the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, is the Sunni tribes. So there's an inherent conflict there. On the one hand, you're working with the Shia in Iraq, and you're working with the Sunni in Syria, and the situation is just not compatible. There is an inherent conflict. And this would seem to me that this is a looming conflict, as Mosul is captured and so is Raqqa. And again, this requires some very deft handling, doesn't it, this looming problem?
Absolutely. The inherent contradiction that you point out, of course, the Trump administration is not responsible for that. That was always present. It was there with the Obama administration. There was plenty of criticism of the Obama White House not having a clear strategy or a clear vision of what the end game is, both in Iraq and especially in Syria. So that isn't, you know, entirely of the Trump administration's making, but you now have a commander in chief who so far doesn't seem interested or isn't providing clear guidance about what he thinks should happen. And then you have this tension between the Pentagon and the State Department and some of these more hawkish people against Iran on the National Security Council. The Pentagon and the State Department are really worried that if you open up a new front in this war in Syria against these Iranian proxy forces and the Assad regime, you're really going to take your eye off the ball in the counter-ISIS fight. And so that's what I think is the inherent sort of tension point between the two sides of this debate. Now, there's probably more than two sides of this debate in Washington, but there's, you know, this from the Pentagon and the State Department, they really want to keep it very narrowly focused. The thing is that events on the ground are pushing them, you know, to make these decisions maybe faster than the Trump administration was ready to.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Brennan, who's the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for foreign policy, and she has an article at Foreign Policy exclusive, White House Officials Push for Widening War in Syria Over Pentagon Objections. So let's turn to your article and the role of Ezra Cohen-Watnick, the Senior Director of Intelligence on the National Security Council, and Derek Harvey, the National Security Council's top Middle East advisor. Both were brought in by General Flynn, who had a very short tenure, as we all know. They're often referred to as the Flynnstones. Both Mattis and McMaster in particular tried to move Ezra Cohen-Watnick off the National Security Council or reassign him, and he went to his friend Jared Kushner and Steve Bannon, and they weighed in on Trump and saved his job. And yet here he is trying to gin up a war with or take on the Iranians. And my understanding with Stephen Bannon is that he was very much affected by his service in the United States Navy during the early Gulf Wars, and has some sort of burning animus about Iran, some kind of grudge. So what do you think motivates these? And Harvey, I mean, he hates Obama. He tried to fire all the Obama people, that the holdovers, I understand.
Harvey, I believe he was a military intelligence analyst. So he worked with Flynn at the Defense Intelligence Agency. But before that, he worked with then General Petraeus in Iraq on the surge back then. So he's a Petraeus protege. He's very focused on Iran. That's sort of been well reported. His deputy or somebody that works for him is also sort of a Petraeus protege that's also focused on Iran. I've heard through my reporting, I learned that some of this focus on Iran comes from the U.S. military's experience in Iraq when so many U.S. troops, you know, were killed by Iranian proxies there, Iranian-supported forces in Iraq. So some of it's, you know, an animus that dates back to that. What I have sort of discovered through my reporting on this White House and the National Security Council that's different for me than when I was reporting on the Obama administration is there aren't just policy differences between cabinet secretaries or the NSC and the Pentagon. There's this overlay of personal vendettas and, you know, that personal dynamics exist in any administration, but they're really strong and they really influence some of these policy debates more so, I think, in the Trump administration. And the media is used in these fights. You know, leaks come and against different wings or factions. And so some of that is also at play in this policy debate, too. I think General Mattis has had run-ins with some of these NSC guys in the short time that Trump has been in the White House. And it's sort of at play again here in this debate about what to do next in Syria, how to counter Iranian provocation, and whether or not to go after Assad more. So it's interesting, as I report on it, to see how the personality conflicts also influence some of these policy decisions.
Well, Iran's never been particularly popular, has it? I mean, the great Satan mantra has been going on for decades, and it would seem to me there's a broader context of payback, even going back to the hostage crisis itself. But there's no question that the Quds Force played a key role in the deaths of many Americans. They even kidnapped a bunch and murdered them. So I could see why there's a lot of grudge or an impulse for payback. But what do you who do you think Trump is listening to? Isn't that the key question here?
Absolutely. I don't have any personal insight in this particular debate. I do know up until this point that Mattis has successfully said no to some of these proposals. But I think the debate is far from resolved. I think we'll get more evidence as time goes on where this is all headed. He has, as you described, McMaster, when he took over the National Security Council from Michael Flynn, he did try to move Ezra Cohen-Watnick to a new job. He's not well trusted by the intelligence community. And he was unsuccessful because Trump himself stepped in and let him keep his job. So I don't know where Trump's loyalties lie. I think he has a lot of faith and confidence in General Mattis. We've seen that as he delegates a lot of authority and responsibility to him. But I think Mattis, you know, there's a target on Mattis's back by, you know, whether it's the Bannon faction in the White House or others. Mattis is very much more of the foreign policy establishment. He's not have this disruptive, you know, tendency that Bannon brings to the White House. So I wouldn't be surprised if Mattis has a target on his back from some of these other factions within the White House. And I'm sure if that's the case that he's aware of it.
Well, I don't know whether you saw the video, but it was pretty extraordinary of the entire cabinet doing a kind of round robin, sycophantically praising the president,
right,
almost like a North Korean cabinet meeting. But the only person in that entire group that wasn't sort of unctuous and sycophantic and frankly embarrassing was General Mattis. He basically, rather than praise the great leader, Donald Trump, he praised the U.S. military. So it seems like he's carving out a certain amount of independence there. And he, as you point out, he has a target on his back. But in general, don't we need this guy? I mean, if we lost Mattis and we lost McMaster, then the lunatics would really be in charge of the asylum.
I think that cabinet meeting you're describing, I'm sure that moment wasn't lost on Trump either. There was plenty of coverage that Mattis did not do what everybody else did, and I'm sure Trump is aware of that. I think right now, I don't think Trump has the political capital, and he knows what a cost it would be, I think, to lose Mattis at this point, even if he's lost his own confidence in him, which I haven't yet found out through my reporting that that's the case with Trump. But I think with McMaster as well, I think that his future is up in the air, which is kind of crazy because it would be amazing if Trump had three different national security advisors within his first year. But I think that that's a possibility. So yeah, I don't think anybody really has job security in the Trump world for very long, but we'll see.
Well, there is some rumor that Trump is supposed to make some kind of announcement on Syria. I mean, I find it pretty extraordinary that at this moment, with Russia threatening any coalition aircraft that flies west of the Euphrates, that they'll be painted by any aircraft radar and will be treated as targets. The Australian pulled out their aircraft from the coalition. I think they've come back in now. But there's obviously some disquiet there. But again, you get back to the notion that Assad knows what he's doing. The Iranians know what they're doing. The Russians know what they're doing. But we don't. And at what point are we going to, I mean, you can blame Obama for ceding the whole field to the Russians. But now it's incredibly embarrassing that the United States clearly doesn't know what it's doing, and Russia is holding the cards and writing the rules.
Yeah, I believe Secretary Mattis presented the White House with a, you know, Trump called for a new counter-ISIS campaign strategy. I believe Secretary Mattis delivered that a few months ago to the White House. It's just been now sitting at the White House. I know that there's a review on Iran's strategy underway, Syria strategy. So there are all these open questions that are waiting for answers. Meanwhile, events on the ground are pushing the U.S. closer and closer and escalating the situation. So absolutely, it's time for the president to make a decision and decide whether it's Afghanistan, Syria, Iran. I don't think the world's going to wait for him. And both within his administration, there are forces trying to fill this vacuum. And also on the sort of world stage, foreign powers are stepping in while the U.S. sort of sits on the sideline.
Do you get any impression from your military and intelligence sources that as institutions, the Pentagon and the IC are somewhat embarrassed by the U.S. simply not being in the game? They're on the field, but they're not in the game. I'm not talking about going to war here, for God's sake, because that's, you know, General Dunford's made it real clear that this is a dangerous situation. They don't want being dragged into a shooting war with the Russians like the Guns of August in 1914, where incidental players create havoc and then the big guys are drawn in. But on the other hand, as a follower of foreign policy myself, I just find the situation embarrassing that the U.S. is totally absent. And they're on the field, but they're absent in terms of strategy, direction. It's just extraordinary.
Well, I think in addition to being absent, there's also so much contradiction. I think the case of Qatar is a really good example of that, where you have Rex Tillerson at the State Department trying to defuse the situation, figure out what exactly the Saudis want, and condemning what they've done, blockading Qatar, while you have the president supporting the move. So I think the confusion, the contradiction, it's an impossible environment to operate in as whether you're a general at the Pentagon or you're a State Department diplomat. I think it's a very difficult environment in which to do your job.
So just in closing then, Kate Brennan, we don't know when there'll be any clarity. I mean, as you pointed out earlier, the world is not waiting for us. But there's just a whole, there's no decisions that have been made yet on Afghanistan. And there is clearly things are moving fast on the ground in Syria. There's a kind of post-conflict, if you will, jockeying going on for territory, involving a complex mosaic of different players. If ever there was a moment for some real focus on the foreign policy challenges and need for strategy, this is the moment.
Yeah, I don't think there will be much clarity. I'm not sure that President Trump intends to be personally involved in decisions like this. I'm not sure that he's interested. But obviously, when it comes to Syria, I think in the short term, the Russians have turned off this deconfliction line, which was crucial to avoiding catastrophe in the air between U.S. and Russian aircraft. I would be surprised if that doesn't get turned back on soon. I think it's in both countries' interests, and they'll figure out a way to do that. But in the meantime, I think the debate internally within the White House and within the administration will become more heated, and we'll see who prevails.
Well, Kate Brennan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Kate Brennan, who's the Deputy Managing Editor of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Cockcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Previously, she was a senior reporter covering the Pentagon for foreign policy, and she has an article at Foreign Policy exclusive, White House Officials Push for Widening War in Syria Over Pentagon Objections. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing the elevation of Saudi Arabia's 31-year-old Deputy Crown Prince to the role of Crown Prince.
اكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the Saudi king appointing his son, Mohammed bin Salman, as crown prince over the seniority, if you will, of his nephew, Mohammed bin Nayef, who is well known in the West and particularly in Washington, D.C.? Not really a surprise, given how many portfolios this so-called boy king has taken on.
Well, it didn't really come as a surprise at all, because he has been groomed into becoming the next king. But I think there are problems within the royal family, and I think his father wants to make sure he will be the next king according to the royal family's process before he dies, because the king himself is not healthy. So this is a move to ensure that Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be automatically the next king, because, as I said, there are thousands of these princes. Many of them are a whole lot more experienced than he is and less reckless. Mohammed bin Salman is very reckless and experienced, and the country is paying for all of that, you know, as exemplified by the war in Yemen and now the conflict with Qatar and his attitude toward Iran. The problem with all of this is we have an administration in this country that seems to be actually taking the side of the Saudis. It doesn't make any difference what they do. But I think this is the reason. The reason is to make sure King Salman wants to make sure his son will automatically become the next king.
Well, I think our foreign policy, for what it's worth and how much you can possibly detect any foreign policy, is all about the personality of Donald Trump. And the Saudis rescued him from bankruptcy a while back, and they treated him royally in this visit with the sword dance and all of this stuff and putting his hand on the globe and all that weird stuff. He just had a ball. So they can do no wrong, right?
Well, that's another issue that actually concerned me a lot, and that is I just finished a piece which I'll actually send to you as soon as we get through here. But what concerned me a lot is that the Saudis have almost hired President Trump to become their lobbyist, actually. So he's taking their side, and whatever they do, as you are right, they treated him royally, more than royally. He has never had anything like this done before, nor will he have anything after in terms of the reception he received in Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis are very clever. I mean, his daughter, Ivanka Trump, is the most probably pro-human rights and human rights in his administration. And they turn around, the Saudis in the United Arab Emirates, and gave her $100 million for her charitable organization, which is supposed to be empowering women. And then after they gave her $100 million, she gave a talk to a group of Saudi women elitists under the supervision of a princess, and started praising the Saudis for the steps they have taken for woman equality, which is ridiculously ridiculous.
So what about the idea that first of all, I think it's statistically true, isn't it, that over 60% of the population of Saudi Arabia are in their 20s and younger, and that somehow they think that this crown prince, who's 31 years old, is speaking for this generation? I mean, the House of Saud don't speak for anybody but themselves, and it's an incredibly rich country, and yet I believe that there's 30% of the population live in poverty. So it's an absolutely obscene and one of the most repressive regimes on the planet, yet successive American governments suck up to them, this one more so than ever, in a gross and shameful way. But is there any truth to the idea that putting this young guy in somehow placates the younger generation in Saudi Arabia?
Well, that's his intent, I believe. And I wish him success. I want him to succeed if he's going to do anything good. I'm not here to wish anybody bad, experience. But the fact is that 75% of the Saudi population is below the age of 30. And most of them are very distrustful of the royal family, if not all of them. And they are pretty suppressed people. And they are becoming increasingly vocal through social media and restless. And I think the plan is to placate these people by putting this guy in charge. But there is more to it than that. No, he doesn't represent them. He is not trusted by the Saudis. Whether they are old or young, he is inexperienced. He has almost nothing prior to his father's ascendance to the throne. So the Saudi, he's untested. They talk about this economic reform, which is dubbed as Vision 2030, which is supposed to diversify the Saudi's economy and win the country out of total dependence on oil, which is a very hard thing to do because still 90% of the Saudi revenues come from oil and its byproducts. So the hope, I wish him success if that's what he is looking for, and I think he has actually an opportunity if he's and it will be tested. The opportunity now is that, especially since his father is still alive and seems to be supporting him 100%, I think he could do something that will give the Saudi young people, young and old, but young people, and more importantly, women, Saudi women, which is half of the society, which is probably one of the most disfranchised people in the world. He can do things like allowing women to drive and restrain the religious establishment, which is still opposed to everything, including music and freedom of little movements. He could do some of these tips while his father is alive. In that way, he can actually prove to the Saudi people that he is serious about change, and he represents the group of people you mentioned. And he may have chance to do some success. The problem, as you mentioned earlier, this is an absolute monarchy, the last absolute monarchy in the world. And their first and most urgent and important item in their agenda is their survival, not only survival, but domination, not only in Saudi Arabia, but in the Gulf states, as we are seeing in Bahrain and Qatar now and Yemen, but also in the whole Muslim and Arab world. And this is what the current administration in this country, Mr. Trump, did in his visit to Saudi Arabia. He actually put the Saudi royal family in charge of Sunni Muslim affairs by inviting all of these heads of states who came to Saudi Arabia not because they love Trump or the Saudis, but because they are in the Saudi and the United Arab Emirates payroll. So they have to come and listen to Trump and share with him their concern about terrorism, which is something they cannot live without. Arab regimes and Muslim regimes cannot survive without terrorism, because they have no other use in the West other than pretending that they are fighting terrorism. So the situation now is pretty fragile. We really didn't know why this change happened all of a sudden, except the fact that the king probably went to ensure his son ascendance to the throne after he's no longer alive or ruling. But time will tell. Time will tell and tell very soon.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, he's lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reform in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. So when you talk about the blockade of Qatar and, of course, this war in Yemen that's the young boy king bogged the country down in, and, of course, they don't have a military per se because the royal family's afraid of anybody else, so they've split the military into three different components. And let's talk a little bit about what this young guy's trying to do with Qatar. I know the Saudi royals are freaked out by Qatar's independence, particularly Al Jazeera, which is a very powerful tool throughout the world. They set up Al Arabiya to try and counter it, but there's no question that the Arab world watches and listens to Al Jazeera. And I believe that is one of the demands that the Saudis have in this, what looks like an attempted coup against the royal family in Qatar, is to one of their demands is to close down Al Jazeera or to rein it in.
Yes, look, this is something. I just finished a piece that your audience can benefit from it a lot, and it is titled "Settling Scores with Qatar and the Guise of Defeating Terrorism." And it's on our website, which is www.cdhr.info. www.cdhr.info. I will send it to you personally, but I think your audience can benefit because I summarized all the points you just mentioned about Al Jazeera and the conflict with Qatar and Yemen and Bahrain. But the point, the current conflict between Qatar and its neighbors is it has been in the making for many decades, actually. After the British mandate, all of this is summarized in this article I just quoted to you, or I just told you. After the British mandate, after Qatar gained its independence from the Britons, from the British in 1971, the Saudis and the British wanted Qatar to become part of the other United Arab Emirates states, and Qatar refused. And then the Saudis declared themselves at the time, 1971, as the keeper of Qatar. And the emir who used to rule Qatar, which is the grandfather of this current emir, was toppled by his son, the father of the current emir, in 1995. And after 1995, the Qataris became independent with their policies, and they embarked on massive political, social, and economic reforms, which the Saudis didn't like, and the other small kings didn't, and the Gulf state didn't like. But what really scared the Saudis and the other rulers in the Gulf is when the grandfather of the current emir of Qatar was deposed by his son peacefully, they were terrified that it could happen to them also by their own opponent and their royal families. So the issue with Qatar is deep, long, historical, which is summarized in the article I mentioned to you. It's on our website. But the Prince Mohammed bin Salman, due to his inexperience, is very reckless, very risky, and invading Yemen and continue to occupy Bahrain and getting into this conflict with Qatar are indicative of his inexperience, but also indicative of his recklessness and aggressive personal manner, which he couldn't actually do any of these things without his father's approval and support. But because he himself is inexperienced, he did what his father wanted him to do, and without any questioning. So, but his recklessness and the risk he's taking can be actually used positively inside Saudi Arabia, not outside Saudi Arabia. He could do quite a bit inside the country. One of it is to empower Saudi women, to call or to support elections, for example, for the Consultative Council or Majlis al-Shura, to get rid of the Saudi religious extremists and the muftis and fatwas and all of these things, and to empower the Saudi young, share power with the Saudi people to build their own country instead of depending on government and Trump and the Washington lobbyists and other people who are in it only to get money from the Saudis. So his recklessness and his risk-taking manner and behavior could be used inside the country to create a better society and more open society and more tolerant society and more open society. That is what's needed to stabilize Saudi Arabia. That is what's needed to avoid more recruits for extremist and terrorist groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and others. And this is where his risk-taking can pay very positively. But he's using it outside the country, and he's threatening Iran to carry the war into Iran instead of having Iran bring it to the Saudi borders. So, again, he has an opportunity, whether he's going to be doing it, if that's what he wants to do. But there is no better opportunity for him to do something constructively. First of all, to save his royal family, if that's what he is interested in, and I'm sure that is, but to also save the country from disintegration.
So, again, the website for the article that you're talking about, Ali Al-Yami, is settling the score with Qatar in the guise of defeating terrorism, is at cdhr.info, right?
Yes, CDHR, like Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia.
So, let's turn back to the palace intrigue. Obviously, Prince Nayef, who was the crown prince, is now, the deputy crown prince, he's been skipped over. He's very popular in the West, as I mentioned, particularly well-known in Washington, former head of the Interior, intelligence, etc., in Saudi Arabia, seems to be very pro-Western. I mean, the young king, or soon-to-be king, the boy king, as they call him, I believe he's actually quite a hardcore Wahhabi, and he wasn't educated outside of the country, as most of the princes were. So there's some doubt about how sophisticated he is, but there's no doubt about Nayef being pretty sophisticated. So is he taking this well, or is if you go ahead and tell us what's going on behind the scenes here, because I imagine a lot of these princes who've been passed over aren't too happy.
No, the princes are not too happy since King Salman took over. He actually disenfranchised, marginalized all of the well-seasoned and experienced princes, like Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi ambassador to Washington for 23 years. But there are many, and also by deposing the former Crown Prince Mugrin, who was half-brother of King Salman, he cleansed them all out and put his son, his intent, King Salman, from the very outset, long before King Abdullah died. His intent is to restore the Sudairis, basically his family, the Sudairis, which is a branch of this wing of the Saudi ruling family, and to power, total power, because his belief is that only his wing of the family can maintain the control of the country under the ruling family. So there are lots of things we didn't know. There are many powerful princes that are being muzzled, otherwise they could be speaking. And my main concern is with the administration we have in this country, we will end up being involved in the affairs of the Saudis in the Gulf region and being involved in more wars and more conflicts. These are the things that President Trump campaigned against, that the United States is not going to police the world or get involved. I think he will get more involved than any of his predecessors, actually.
Sure. Well, look, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.